come forward for 17-3238, U.S. v. Ackerman. Are you ready to proceed? Thank you.
Judge Hartz, and may it please the court, my name is Dan Hansmeyer. I'm an attorney with the Federal Defender's Office for the District of Kansas, and I represent the appellant, Walter Ackerman. This court has already reversed the district court's suppression ruling in this case once. It should do so again. On remand from this court, the district court below held that Mr. Ackerman could not challenge the warrantless search of his email because the government conducted the warrantless search after a third-party service provider terminated Mr. Ackerman's email account. The district court's third-party termination rule is unprecedented, unworkable, and unwise. This court should reverse. So let's start with, first principles. We know over a century ago in Ex parte Jackson, the United States Supreme Court held that our mail is protected by the Fourth Amendment, wherever it may be, while it's in the process of being delivered. I think what we know at this point is that from this court's decision, first time around, is that electronic mail is in effect under the Fourth Amendment, just like physical mail. The Fourth Amendment applies in the same manner. It's protected. We know in this case the government searched the mail without a warrant. And it's our position, straightforward application of Ex parte Jackson, this was a warrantless search. Suppression is the remedy. So when we think about the way we view this case, essentially the government needs an exception. Now, obviously, there are all kinds of exceptions to the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement, but we know that none of the traditional ones apply here. I think, obviously there was no warrant. The government tried a private search doctrine. This court in the first decision rejected that and said that what the government did expanded the scope of the search. So the private search doctrine doesn't work. And as far as a third-party doctrine, because we have a third party here, the government doesn't rely on that, and that's probably wise in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Carpenter. So what do we have? What is the exception? And so the government and the district court, we think, just created one out of whole cloth, this third-party termination rule. We don't think that there is any support for that, especially in the context of mail. And we don't think this court should adopt it. We think this court should reject it, particularly under the facts of this case, and particularly because this involves mail. And when we look at what happened in this case, the third-party termination did not occur until after Mr. Ackerman sent the mail, right? So he hits send. The mail goes out. AOL runs its hashtag. The computer does its thing. Identify suspected child pornography, and then, according to the evidence, the email account is suspended, terminated.
Why does the fact that the crime was committed before he lost possession make a difference? If the analogy that the government brings is someone evicted,
mm-hmm.
say for not paying rent,
mm-hmm.
what if the evidence that's left in the room relates to a crime that occurred earlier? I don't think the fact that the offense occurred before the eviction or abandonment or whatever is relevant. I'm not saying you don't have some good arguments here, mm-hmm. but that one I don't understand.
Well, I think there's a disconnect between the hotel search cases and mail in particular.
Well,
and
but focus on the point I'm raising.
Yes, right.
Which is why it makes a difference, yep. when the crime was occurred as opposed to when the search occurred.
And it's because it's mail. Because the baseline rule with mail is that it's protected until it's delivered to the intended recipient. The expiration period, if you will, ends when it's delivered. So, and I think that's the analogy. So when you have a hotel room, you have a period in which the room is rented. If you analogize that to mail, the period in which the Fourth Amendment protects mail is until it's delivered. And in this case, the mail was intercepted. It was never delivered. And therefore, there was no actual expiration sort of under Ex parte Jackson's framework. So it really is this case differs because we're talking about mail and we're talking about this baseline rule that has been in existence for over a century. Now, I'll also say about the hotel search cases that I think they were wrong. I think this court should treat the hotel search cases like the Supreme Court treated the third-party doctrine in Carpenter. I think
well,
when you look
it
at
just,
it...
Isn't it standard common law practice that when you're evicted and you leave for, say, non-payment rent, and you leave some chattels in the room, that the landlord can sell those chattels?
Absolutely not. That's absolutely not the rule. That's not the rule in, under the state statutes. If you look at Croft, Croft was decided in 1970, three years after Katz.
I'm not talking about Supreme Court cases on search and seizure. I'm talking about common law. What happens to the property
of
someone who's evicted from an apartment?
So you look, if you look at the state statutes, if you
can't, I thought that the landlord can seize that property and sell it to help pay for the rent. That's not correct.
I mean, that's true under certain circumstances, but essentially reverts to a bailment. So if we leave our stuff in our hotel room, and I think this is obvious for any of us some of us have been in hotel rooms all week. If we leave something in our room, the hotel becomes our bailee. And we have an opportunity to come get our stuff. Now, there are certain instances when, you know, obviously if we don't come get it, then we forfeited our rights in it. Or if we owe money and we refuse to pay, then there are provisions that allow the hotel to recoup their fees by selling our stuff.
That's all I asked, was that mm-hmm. last situation, right?
Right, but that's completely different than mail. I mean, there's nobody in this case is saying that AOL needs to recoup fees by selling Mr. Ackerman's emails. I mean, it's just entirely, we think it's an apples to oranges type comparison. And really what you have here, you don't need to look elsewhere. You can look at the mail cases. Jacobson was a mail case. It involved a private carrier where something was sent, intercepted, a private search happened. That's the question. The question is, what did the private party do? And in Jacobson, they conducted a search. The government did the same thing. That's okay. Here, the government is trying to say AOL's termination of an email account, which is really, I mean, at the end of the day, it has nothing to do with the email that was already sent. I mean, that email is long gone. It's out of the account. The termination of the account should be irrelevant. There's a disconnect between what the government's looking, the action of the private party has did nothing to frustrate Mr. Ackerman's privacy rights or property rights in this email. And when we talk about ownership and we talk about property rights in emails, in our letters, the idea that AOL somehow owned Mr. Ackerman's emails, I think, should ring hollow. When we write our letters, they're our words. It doesn't matter what, you know, the third party carrier we hire to deliver those things. It's not their message. If we write an email that is critical of AOL, we wouldn't say that AOL owns up to that email and it's their property. It's just not true. It's our stuff. And in this case, the termination of the account did nothing to upset Mr. Ackerman's rights in that email. And we know that under established precedent.
The argument so far is within the privacy theory of a violation. And the parties have argued back and forth a bit on whether the terms of service affect mm-hmm. that privacy interest. Yeah. In other words, once the termination happens, is there something about the terms of service that would extinguish mm-hmm. the privacy interest? Could you yeah. speak to that?
Well, we think that what the district court did on the terms of service happened before the Supreme Court's decision in Byrd. And we think when you consider what the Supreme Court said in Byrd, it's pretty clear that, you know, our constitutional rights do not depend on a private contract between us and a third party. And there's good reasons for that. I mean, the contract is more commercial. I mean, AOL's interest in having those terms of service has nothing to do with privacy rights. They don't have, it's about their interests.
Well, let me ask you this, and I know this isn't the language in the terms of service here, but if AOL had required Mr. Ackerman, before he can get the service, the email account, to agree that AOL at its sole discretion can look at emails, monitor them, audit them, open them, and he agrees to that, I take it you would agree that there isn't an expectation of privacy then.
For Fourth Amendment purposes?
Yes.
I would not agree with that, no. I mean, I think it's a closer call, and I think there are cases from other circuits that say that. And I think maybe if you're talking about if we ignore the property aspect of it.
Right. I'd like to ignore that for the time being, yes.
I mean, I think it's a tougher case. I don't want to concede anything in this case, to be honest with you. But it's definitely a tougher case than we have here because we don't have an.
Well,
terms
I just
of service.
I guess I'm pushing this a bit to see if what your position really is. Is the terms of service don't mean anything
for Fourth Amendment purposes? I think that's pretty much true, and I think Byrd said that. I think maybe you have a case where something happens on the front end that would negate some sort of property rights in your items, but this certainly isn't that case. But yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to draw those lines in this case because AOL's terms of service did not explicitly say that we're going to inspect, we're going to examine, we're going to monitor. None of that was in there. And so I don't think you need to cross that line in this case. I think what's, and really, I think this is my best answer to you on the terms of service. It's unworkable. Because think about this case. When you're talking about, you know, the Fourth Amendment, it controls what law enforcement does, right? So there are rules for police officers. Now, in this case, the government officials had no clue that this account was terminated. So to draw a line at the terms of service and what they mean, and how is that going to play out in the field? When police officers, when they're doing these things, this really isn't this case of post hoc rationale. It's, oh, by the way, we did this, and oh, look, AOL had to happen to have terminated the account, and now we're going to sort of justify what we did based on that. And I think that goes to workability. I think it's a huge problem when you start looking at these terms of service and saying, we're going to start drawing Fourth Amendment lines based on terms of service because law enforcement in the field, you know, these government officials, they're not reading the terms of service before they're doing these things. So I think you have a really big workability problem.
Let me just move to this, the so-called trespass theory. Am I correct? You didn't argue that in your original motion to suppress.
Yeah, that came from this court's earlier decision.
Right. And was it argued on remand?
Yes. Yeah, we briefed the trespass theory pretty heavily. Okay. And then the government. I do want to stay on good faith. My time is apparently. I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, but I do want to say on good faith. You know, the law of the case doctrine, the government lost this appeal. It did. The first time around, the government lost. And I just want to leave you with, you know, we could have won the first time around outright. This court could have just reversed. It could have done that. It didn't. It sent it back for some findings on a theory, third-party doctrine, that the government ended up waiving. But if we would have won outright, the first time around, the good faith exception would have been gone because the government didn't.
That's not the way it works.
But it would have, it could have worked.
No. I don't understand that conception of what happened in the first appeal.
No, I'm not saying that's what happened.
No. But I don't see why. I don't understand your argument that the good faith issue isn't before us.
Okay.
Because good faith was argued by the government at the original suppression motion, right?
Yes.
The court didn't address that. The district court.
Correct.
It denied the motion to suppress on other grounds.
Correct.
On appeal, the government can, any appellee, can
correct.
Argue alternative grounds for affirmance.
Correct.
They made a weak effort at that. We said that wasn't an adequate effort. So we essentially treated it as if that issue were not raised as an alternative ground for affirmance. Then after the reversal, that issue remains before the district court. In fact, if they had argued that alternative ground for affirmance, our typical practice would be the district court didn't address that in the first instance, so we'll send it back to the district court to decide that. That's the typical way. We do not require appellees to raise all the alternative grounds for affirmance. We send it back, we reverse the ground on which the district court acted, and then the other grounds are still before the district court for resolution.
But the government did raise it, and it was a waiver. The government waived the issue.
They waived it as an argument, as an alternative ground for affirmance in that appeal. we treated it essentially as if they hadn't argued an alternative ground for affirmance.
Well, here's what this court said a year ago. Quote, if there's an appeal from the judgment entered after remand, the decision on the first appeal establishes the law of the case to be followed on the second.
Yes.
What happened in the first appeal is that the government waived the good faith exception. If that's law of the case in this, on this appeal, the government waived the good faith exception.
It didn't have to. If it were the appellant, you would be absolutely right. But the appellee has no obligation to raise alternative grounds for affirmance.
But they did.
No,
I mean, that's
the
distinction.
We said they tried and failed. But if they had, I suspect we would have said, this is for the district court to decide in the first instance. That's usually how appellate courts work. Occasionally, if it's very straightforward, we might affirm on that alternative, on an alternative ground. But I don't think it's a proper characterization of the first appeal to say you can't deal with that. Take a tort case where there's a motion for summary judgment. The defendant argues elements 1 and 2 of the claim there wasn't sufficient evidence. The district court says, I agree with you on element 1, I'm not going to address element 2. It's appealed. We reverse the district court. That leaves element 2 remaining for the district court to decide. You're suggesting that an appellee who doesn't raise alternative grounds for affirmance, no, because you're saying they waived it.
Yes.
They waived it for the purpose of that appeal. We could not address that issue on that appeal. That's all we said.
And the law of the case doctrine says that the law of the case from the first appeal applies thereafter. And that waiver controls in every subsequent proceeding.
We were not going to decide that on the first appeal. We treat it as not having been raised at all. So it can be, then following our absolutely standard practice, it can be addressed on remand.
Yeah. I mean, I'm out of time. So.
No, I know you're out of time, but it's an important issue.
Yeah. No, I think
If it's not waived,
okay.
If contrary to, if we read our opinion as conforming to the standard practice of this court, why isn't it a good argument?
Can I just say one more thing about the prior opinion, then
sure,
I'll move on?
Sure,
and that
sure.
is that this court talked about various exceptions, including the good faith section, and then it said, in other cases. But beyond that, good faith exception doesn't apply in this case because the statutory scheme is a third-party duty to report statute. It requires third-party service providers to report suspected child pornography to NCMEC. There is nothing, and then NCMEC has to report that information to law enforcement. So it's sort of like a clearinghouse. There's nothing within the statutory scheme that requires NCMEC to conduct warrantless searches. And there is, in the language from, there is language from the first opinion that the government talks about, but there's also other language that supports us, quote, Congress's statutes don't require NCMEC to open and view email and attachments like Mr. Ackerman's.
What are you reading from there?
That's from the first decision, page 1302 from Ackerman 1. So this court said that. And I think what's important when you compare and contrast the statutory scheme in Illinois v. Kroll with this one is that Kroll involved a licensing scheme.
But the language from Ackerman 1 said require.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that's different from authorizing, right? Require doesn't mean authorize.
I mean, I think it may be.
Well, look, the other statement. I'll give you one of the other statements.
Yes.
But everyone accepts that Congress has authorized and funded the National Center to do just that.
Yes.
That is, view email and attachments.
No, I understand. There's definitely language that goes both ways. I'm not denying that.
Well, I'm saying that I'm not sure that they're irreconcilable.
Mm-hmm.
If the panel said that the commission isn't required, that's not the same thing as saying it's different to say that they could.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's true. The only other thing I would say is that this court also said in Ackerman, can I just get this out?
Yes.
Is that this court expressly contrasted the NCMEC scheme with state licensing schemes, and that is precisely the type of statute that was at issue in Illinois v. Kroll's state license scheme. It authorized the inspection examination of vehicles and premises, which is much more of a search scheme than the one at issue here. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, John Taddy for the United States. As some of the Court's questions were indicating, this case involves difficult issues with respect to the application of the Fourth Amendment in the electronic space, but I'd like to start out where the Court ended on the good faith issue because it's the government's position that it does provide the most straightforward path to affirming the District Court's denial of suppression in this case. As several of the Court's questions just now were indicating, this Court in Ackerman 1 already made many of the legal determinations with respect to the statutes governing NCMEC's operation of the cyber tip line that are also relevant with respect to the good faith inquiry under Krull. As Judge Matheson suggested when he was quoting from the original Ackerman opinion, this Court wrote in Ackerman 1 at page 1297 that Congress authorized NCMEC to receive contraband knowingly and to review its contents intentionally.
Well, counsel, it's also the case that Ackerman 1 didn't address the good faith issue. And I understand I talked about that language, but now what I'd like you to do is talk about the statute.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what specific statutory language would authorize the opening of email and files to search for child pornography?
Yes, Your Honor. So the statutory language that this Court looked to make those assertions in Ackerman 1 was specifically 18 U.S.C. section 2258A, big A, little A, and B. In those particular statutes, what Congress established was a statutory regime where if an Internet service provider finds illicit content such as child pornography on its systems, it's required to submit a report to NCMEC, and I'm going to quote from the statutory language at 2258AA, make a report of such facts or circumstances to the cyber tip line. And then in B, it indicates what the report is supposed to include. The report may include, and I'm quoting again, various pieces of information, quote, including any image of apparent child pornography related to the incident. And then in subpoint 5, the complete communication containing any image of apparent child pornography. And based on this language, as well as the language included in 42 U.S.C. section 5773B1P, that statute has changed since the past decision. It's now at 34 U.S.C. section 112.9.3. And what this is the financing provision for NCMEC where Congress requires certain funds to be made available to NCMEC so it can operate the cyber tip line. What that language says is that Congress shall make a grant which shall be used to operate a cyber tip line to provide ISPs effective means of reporting Internet-related child exploitation and subsequently to transmit such reports, and this is the important language, including relevant information and images to the appropriate international, federal, state, or local law enforcement agency. That relevancy determination strongly indicates that NCMEC is supposed to review these reports that are provided by Internet service providers, identify whether or not the images contained within the report actually are child pornography, so whether they are relevant images, and then forward that.
Well, let me just stop there. I mean, I guess what I'm having trouble with is deriving from that that they can pull out the letter opener and open the envelope, or I suppose the electronic letter opener. Where does it say they can do that? I mean, the ISP in this instance, they run their standard screen. They think, whoa, it looks like there might be child pornography here. So they send their report, and the commission gets the report, and to the extent that they do serve as kind of an initial screen or a clearinghouse, and then send it on to law enforcement, I get that part, but I'm just trying to get a sense of why they think they could open the files.
Yeah, I think that statutory language, particularly stating that NCMEC basically has the authority to pass along relevant images, not just all images. Congress used the word relevant, and it must have used it for a particular purpose. And I also think that the implication of the language, though this Court wrote in Ackerman 1 that these statutes don't require NCMEC to review the content of the reports, this court made what I would submit as a legal determination, because it was relevant to whether or not NCMEC is a government entity or agent, as to what these statutes mean. This court said that NCMEC has special powers and authorities under the statutory regime to receive and review child pornography when it was conducting that analysis at pages 1297 and pages 1302. But aside from that, Your Honor, even if there's nothing in the statute that explicitly says NCMEC absolutely has the authority to look at child pornography it receives from an internet service provider, the standard here for the good faith exception is whether this is an objectively reasonable view of this particular statute. The assertions made by this court the first time around in Ackerman 1 indicate that it was objectively reasonable for NCMEC to think, as this court said, everyone accepts that Congress has authorized and funded NCMEC to look at these reports and to view these images contained with them, not just to sort of act as, you know, I'm thinking of those old pneumatic tube systems where you receive the pneumatic tube, you pop it back in and send it along. It has a role to play in the actual examining of these reports. So on that side, it was reasonable for NCMEC to conduct.
Have you really ever seen a pneumatic tube? You don't look old enough.
I have, actually, Your Honor. There was a grocery store I used to go to, and I was fascinated by them, probably why I'm thinking of them right now. In addition, we have to consider whether there would be an appreciable deterrence benefit to suppressing this evidence. Courts have conducted this analysis, particularly the Keith decision out of the District of Massachusetts, said that there's no real reasonable allegation that NCMEC has to be deterred to act in a way that appeared to be consistent with full congressional intent.
Is that the deterrence analysis, is it separate and apart from the statutory analysis? In other words, we look at the statute and is there objective reasonable reliance on the statute? And we get through with that one way or the other. Maybe we think it's close, maybe we don't, I don't know. But then there's this deterrence, kind of more generalized consideration of whether exclusion would perform a deterrence function. Is that a freestanding issue?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the way that the Supreme Court has discussed it makes it seem at times as if it's sort of a bifurcated analysis. But I would submit that the reasonableness of the interpretation of a particular statute or reliance on a warrant or reliance on binding precedent and other applications of the good faith exception also informs whether or not there would be a deterrence value to suppressing particular evidence. In this circumstance, and another point we make in our brief, NCMEC didn't even know that it was a government entity at this point in time. Other courts, particularly the First Circuit in Cameron, suggested that it was not. This was the first court, and to my knowledge, the only court that has held that NCMEC is a government entity. And that further indicates the reasonableness of NCMEC's behavior. I would also submit that Congress would not have had to create this entire statutory regime, specifically setting out NCMEC's responsibilities and its privileges to review child pornography if Congress hadn't considered NCMEC to be a private entity in and of itself. Of course, that determination cannot be reversed at this juncture. That was a decision made in Ackerman 1 in its binding precedent. But at the time, both the statutory language itself, the way that courts had previously dealt with NCMEC, and the fact that it seemed to sort of had this special place as this private entity until this court's holding, all suggest that NCMEC's reliance on the statute was eminently reasonable. If this court would like, I'm also happy to answer questions about our arguments related to the reasonable expectation of privacy. There were some questions about the hotel cases that we've invoked.
Before you, can I get you to address why you think we can even talk about good faith, why that has not been waived here?
Yes, Your Honor. So, I some of the questions that Judge Hartz was directing to opposing counsel at the beginning, I think, get to sort of the heart of why we believe that the law of the case does not preclude the government from making this argument. We made this argument before the district court at the beginning of this case in the first denial of suppression. We attempted to make it again, even though the district court did not address it in that first decision before this court the last time around. This court found, for reasons of its own circuit rules with respect to preserved arguments that we had not adequately briefed that particular argument. It did not reach an issue on the merits, which is the critical language in this court's precedent. We cite on page 40 of our brief cases like Wilmer and Whitting and several others that say that the court must address the merits of the decision. The decision that the government had not adequately briefed and addressed the good faith issue was not a legal determination on the merits that NCMEC did not act in good faith. That's the fundamental difference, I think, here between our position and Mr. Ackerman's position. They try to maintain that that decision was a decision on the merits, but in my opinion, it does not seem that that is a decision on the merits. It doesn't reach the core question of whether NCMEC acted in an objectively reasonable manner. It doesn't address whether or not NCMEC reasonably relied on the statutory regime here in an objective manner. It doesn't deal with any of the deterrence benefits or lack thereof of suppression, so that wasn't a decision on the merits. And ultimately, Your Honors, the decision of whether to apply law of the case principles is one of equity and judicial economy and efficiency. Both parties have now fully briefed the good faith issue, both before the district court on the most recent remand, as well as before the Court of Appeals, and it's well preserved at this point, and in the interest of justice, this court should consider it as a basis for affirming the district court's denial of suppression. Mr. Ackerman has already entered into a conditional plea, assuming liability for the child pornography crimes that he has committed. The cost of suppression would be significant in this particular case. So for those reasons, the government's position is that law of the case does not bar consideration of the good faith issue.
Could I just,
yes, Your Honor.
Before we leave good faith, to what extent can you rely on the Kroll authority when it addressed administrative searches? Is there some limit on how far that takes you?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The question is whether there is a statutory regime under Kroll. The question is whether there is a statutory regime that the government has reasonably relied on. And we cite several cases in our brief while discussing Kroll and the defendant's arguments. And I'm looking specifically at page 45 of our brief. I'm sure that that's the correct point.
Well, if you've said that in your brief, we're running out of time. You'd like to...
Yeah, well, to put a pin in it, Your Honor, we rely on several situations where it's not just an administrative statute, it's criminal statutes, misdemeanor offenses, different statutes that run the full run of the code in which this court has applied the Kroll principle to find good faith. With respect to reasonable expectations of privacy, we do maintain that those hotel cases are the appropriate analog in this circumstance. The defendant himself relies on the Sixth Circuit opinion in Warshak regarding reasonable expectation of privacy in email. Warshak itself relied on hotel cases in order to say that every time sort of a maid goes in and tidies up, that doesn't reduce a reasonable expectation of privacy in email writ large. But what's interesting about those cases, particularly Allen from the First Circuit, is they do hold, consistent with many of this court's opinions in the hotel realm, that once an individual has been evicted from a hotel room, the reasonable expectation of privacy in that hotel room no longer exists. And it's the government's position that that's the appropriate analog here. What Mr. Ackerman was essentially doing was renting space on AOL servers. And once he used his email account to send child pornography, he was immediately thrown offline, evicted from the service, unable to access or sign back online. After that point in time is when AOL sent the copy of the email that he had attempted to send through the cyber tip line to NCMEC, which then looked at the copy of that particular email. In the physical space, we would be making the same argument. The defendant argues that, you know, that mail is special, that it has a particular point of protection. But the analogy here to the physical space would be if you were to take a FedEx box and you were to put a bomb in it and you were to walk to FedEx and a drug-sniffing dog were to immediately alert at FedEx, a FedEx drug-sniffing dog, that the box contained a bomb after you've handed it over to FedEx, and FedEx says, our dog has indicated that there's a bomb here, you get out. You know, there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of that package at that point in time. And the same analysis should apply in the email space in this particular case. This is not an argument that individuals wholesale do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their email. That's not a position we have taken in this brief. It's not a question that is presented by this case. The question is whether under the particular circumstances of this case, whether Mr. Ackerman had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the content of this particular email at the time that NCMEC reviewed it. We've also made arguments regarding why this court's suggestion in the first Ackerman opinion that the Jones physical trespass doctrine applies is wrong. This court would be the first court if it were to hold that those physical, excuse me, Your Honor, I see that my time is up. If I may finish that point.
You took an extra 4 minutes. You have a little leeway.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. No court has held that the Jones physical trespass test applies in the electronic space. Our brief sets forth some of the reasons for why that is, particularly the court's rejection
unless,
of justice.
Unless this court did.
Unless this court's decision was a holding in that first case, it's our position that it was not a holding. There would have been no reason to remand this case back to the district court for a reasonable expectation of privacy analysis if it had found that there was a physical trespass. Because if there was a physical trespass, that's a Fourth Amendment violation, and it's irrelevant whether or not an expectation of privacy existed or did not exist. We've cited in our briefs, again, many reasons for why we believe that that was dicta. I know, Judge Hartz, you didn't join that portion of the opinion in the original panel. But I would say that for the reasons set forth in our brief, there are many reasons why property concepts do not have a ready analog in the electronic space, why the Supreme Court has been so careful to cabin cases like Jones and Jardines and not extend the analysis to the electronic space. Justice Gorsuch's attempt to sort of expand that in Carpenter was rejected by the majority of that court. And I would urge this court to consider the wall that the Supreme Court has established between those cases.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll give you a minute. I shouldn't be doing this if you don't want to, but I thought there's enough meat in this case that you might have a minute's worth of response.
Sure. Thanks. I will make 5 points. I will. Real fast. So on law of the case, there are three exceptions. New evidence, intervening authority, clearly erroneous original order. None of those exceptions apply. The government's relying on something else. This idea that a merits determination is different than a waiver determination. If you look at Concrete Works, I think that's the best example of a situation where the defendant waived an issue on appeal. That was law of the case moving forward. Those are my first 2 points. Third, there's no, as far as on the merits of good faith, the question under Davis is whether there's the officers relied on binding appellate precedent, not whether there was no appellate precedent. The government's flipped that on its head. Cameron, real quick, this is what Cameron says. NCMEC effectively acted as an agent of law enforcement. That's what Cameron says. So at the time this happened in 2012, the First Circuit told NCMEC it couldn't do this without a warrant. Last point, and I won't say it because I'm out of time. Thank you.
No, say it.
Okay, so my last point is that in this court's prior decision, in four pages from 1296 to 1300, this court, 1296 to 1300, this court mapped out exactly why NCMEC should have known it was a government agent. Thank you.
Just to respond to your second point, I wasn't suggesting that it wasn't a holding that the good faith issue was waived on appeal.
Yeah.
The question is, what does that mean after the case goes back?
And that's why I mentioned Concrete Works.
Okay.
Because if you look at that case, there was a waiver on appeal, and that was law of the case on remand.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Let's take a break for a few minutes, and we'll go back to our last three cases.